Plofchen et al. Versus Plofchen, Jacqueline A. Kramer, Appellants Counsel, Elizabeth Morrow, Michael
has Kirk, left the conference.
Julie M. Porto, Appellees Counsel.
All right.
Please stand by for the transfer.
For the sake of introducing Senior Justice Kuntz, will be sitting on this case. Justice Mintz will not be sitting. And the remainder of the current court is also sitting. All right, Ms. Kramer, are you prepared to start?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jacqueline Kramer, and I represent the appellants in this case. Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
Thank you. And again, I represent the appellants who are the fiduciaries in this matter, and I'm asking this court to reverse the trial court and allow this matter to proceed to trial because the trial court erred in sustaining a plea and bar as to both the issues of collateral estoppel and standing. More importantly, the court's order must be reversed because as it stands now, the trial court's finding erodes the distinction between actions taken in an individual capacity versus actions taken in a fiduciary capacity. Additionally, it also erodes the clear Virginia precedent and standard required for a finding of testamentary capacity as it relates in this case to the revocation of a trust. The trial court here abused its discretion when it received no evidence based on the record, and there was no undisputed operative fact that would have foreclosed the litigation via collateral estoppel. Ms. Plofchen's assertion of collateral estoppel regarding her capacity is insufficient as a matter of law, which, as you know, collateral estoppel precludes parties and their privies from litigating any issue of fact that was actually litigated and essential to a valid final judgment in a prior action. Here, the appellee, Plofchen, presented no undisputed operative fact that would have foreclosed the fiduciary's right of recovery. First, Your Honors, there was no unity of the parties. For collateral estoppel to apply, the parties or their privies to the two proceedings must be the same. It was undisputed that the court in New York from the prior order did not assert jurisdiction over the fiduciaries in their fiduciary capacity. Additionally, there was no interest of the fiduciaries that is nearly identical as the Virginia standard required to Ms. Plofchen or to the fiduciaries themselves in their individual capacities vis-a-vis a guardianship proceeding. The fiduciaries were only present in the New York case as children of Mrs. Plofchen, and they had no fiduciary obligations therein. What this ruling does, Your Honors, is in essence bind the fiduciaries, parties that weren't present, and with whom Mrs. Plofchen has not presented a nearly identical interest to the ruling of that case. More importantly, Your Honors, the facts sought to be litigated must have been actually litigated at the prior proceeding. In this case, in the Virginia case, the claims are for prohibitive and mandatory injunctive relief as it relates to a trust operation. Absolutely differentiated from the prior self-petition for guardianship under New York law. And contrary to Ms. Plofchen's position, her capacity to contract, here her capacity to revoke her trust in her power of attorney, was not litigated in New York. The facts were different and the standard was different. And in the New York proceeding pursuant to Article 81.02C, the court has the ability to make a determination of incapacity for the limited purpose of appointment of a guardian upon a finding of clear and convincing evidence that that person is likely to suffer harm because he or she is unable to provide for her personal needs or property management and would not appreciate the nature and consequences of that inability. That is the standard specifically for an Article 81 hearing in New York. And the court in that hearing was not required to evaluate Ms. Plofchen's mind and memory to understand her business or the other aspects under Virginia law for testamentary capacity. And indeed, in the court order in New York, the court stated that the court does not find Mrs. Plofchun an incapacitated person under a clear and convincing standard as that term is defined in Article 81 of the Mental Hygiene Law. That was the specific finding. Additionally, what the New York court found was that Mrs. Plofchun had advanced directives and resources in place that would provide for any needs that she had, and therefore the appointment of a guardian was not necessary. That was the finding in New York. And I think, Your Honors, it is interesting to note that under New York law holds that a capacity determination under Article 81 does not apply collaterally to testamentary capacity hearings, and that's in matter of Colby. A finding of incapacity under the Mental Hygiene Law, Article 81, is based upon different factors from those involved in a finding of testamentary capacity.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this question? What is the standard for the weight of evidence in a Virginia testamentary capacity case? Is it clear and convincing, or is it preponderance?
Your Honor, I believe it's preponderance of the evidence on that, but under different factors.
I understand, but let's suppose hypothetically the factors were identical, absolutely, unquestionably identical. Under collateral estoppel law, if the burden of proof is different, clear and convincing in one forum, preponderance in the other, does collateral estoppel even apply at all?
We don't know, Your Honor. I don't believe collateral estoppel. These are totally different issues, whether the burden's the same, whether the factors are the same. And moving into what I was going to say, Your Honor, is there were no facts presented with regard to the burden of proof that Mrs. Plofchun had to present.
Well, truth be told, counsel, if I may come back to it, I'm asking a very friendly question. I'll give you full knowledge. If the facts are identical, if the issues are identical, if the parties are identical, if everything's identical, same black robe, but the burdens of proof are different, burdens of evidentiary sufficiency are different. As you understand the common law of collateral estoppel, would collateral estoppel require issue preclusion in that instance?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that everything, the four factors need to be the same. And if there's a difference in standards, if there's a difference in elements, then the court would have to address that, which the court here did not.
And am I correct that in New York it was clear and convincing, which is a higher bar? Because, I mean, at least a trial judge said as much in the opinion. But in Virginia, it's preponderance for testamentary capacity.
So, yes, Your Honor, in New York, under an Article 81 hearing, for that purpose, for appointment of a guardian only, it requires the clear and convincing standard. But again, clear and convincing to find for a limited purpose that the person is likely to suffer harm. That's the main factor in an Article 81 hearing, which is not present in the Virginia standard or the Virginia capacity to make a will, to make a trust, to understand the nature of your business in which you're engaged, to comprehend the nature of your property and the objects of your bounty. That is not present in the New York standard for which the burden is clear and convincing. It's just the likely to suffer harm. Again, Your Honors, Plofchun's mental capacity was never evaluated under the Virginia testamentary standard as it relates to a revocation. It was only evaluated for purposes of appointing or not appointing a guardian. And on that same vein, Your Honors, the issue must have been essential in collateral estoppel to the prior judgment. Here, the court found that under the New York standard, Mrs. Plofchun did not need a guardian because she was not likely to suffer harm, that she had advanced directives in place which adequately provided for her needs, and therefore no guardian was necessary. So whether she had capacity or not is kind of non-essential to the resolution of that matter. The court said, no, your petition is denied. You have different procedures in place. You have a trust. You have a power of attorney. And that was the only issue that the New York court found on. And lastly, Your Honors, regarding collateral estoppel, there was no valid final judgment against my clients, against the fiduciaries. They were not there either in a representative capacity. The action of a guardianship against Mrs. Plofchun cannot be applied against them. It goes back to the first element. Plofchan here is attempting to bind the fiduciaries, the non-parties and non-privies, to the results of the action of the non-plenary out-of-state guardianship proceeding. And again, it's worth noting, I believe, that Mrs. Plofchan, she was a self-petitioner in New York. She stated under oath that she didn't have capacity and that she needed a guardian, and that relief was denied. Her relief requested the appointment of a guardian was denied by the court because the court found those procedures she had in place, and she was not likely to suffer harm. Moving on, Your Honors, to the second assignment of error, the issue of standing. The trial court abused its discretion when it found there was a lack of standing and it received no evidence of a revocation of the trust and no evidence of a competency at the time of a purported revocation. This, of course, could be Mrs. Plofchan's defense to the lawsuit, defense to the trustee's action here in Virginia, but of course that has not been litigated yet. The fiduciaries here in Virginia pled that Mrs. Plofchan lacked capacity to revoke her fiduciary appointments in paragraph 42 of the complaint. This statement, as well as all the facts pled in the complaint, is deemed true for purposes of a plea in bar when Mrs. Plofchan presents no evidence to counter that. Again, this was not an evidentiary hearing. It was just argument of counsel, which is not evidence. And she presented nothing in support that she had capacity at the time that she purported to revoke that document. The fiduciaries have stated, hey, you tried to revoke it, here's the purported revocation, and proceed on with the lawsuit. Mrs. Plofchan comes in and says, no standing because I revoked it, here's the revocation. Without any additional information, any additional evidence presented by Mrs. Plofchan, she fails to meet her burden on the plea in bar as to standing. And interestingly enough, Your Honors, this court decided Our Lady of Peace versus Morgan, which was on a plea in bar, the same day as this case was being heard on a plea in bar. And in that case, the majority found that the court erred when essentially making a factual determination with regard to, in that case, I believe it was respondeat superior, without any specific evidence of facts that would support a finding of respondeat superior. And in that case, again, it was in the dissent, but Justice Mims pointed out that litigants must be held to their pleading decisions. Mrs. Plofchan chose a plea in bar to challenge the alleged collateral issue, as opposed to challenge the sufficiency of the pleadings on demur. And in presenting no evidence for that plea, failed to meet her burden. There's nothing in the New York court order that would contradict the fiduciary's well-pled facts in their complaint. The New York order doesn't mention the trust being revoked or attempted to be revoked, and Mrs. Plofchan does not present any testimony or evidence on that matter.
Counsel, you're down below 3 minutes. You can use your time any way you like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll reserve my remaining time on the argument, the third assignment for rebuttal. Thank you.
Two minutes, 49 seconds. Ms. Morrow.
I am Julie Porto, Your Honor. I'll be arguing for the appellee, Paula Plofchan. For the last 3 years, Paula has been fighting to take back control of the assets from her children, Thomas and Elizabeth. The first way she did that was by signing revocations of the trust and the power of attorney. And when the children said that those revocations were invalid because she didn't have the capacity to do so, she went to the New York court where she lived and petitioned to have the court assign a guardian to her, which the court did not do. But what it did do was make a factual finding with respect to her capacity. And that was specifically, quote, Paula recognizes that she needs assistance in this regard, and she is capable of determining who she wants to handle her finances. That's that JA 102. And it's this factual finding that Paula based her plea and bar on, not whether the trust was valid or not. And Justice Kelsey, to your question, I think that's the answer. It's important that the court did ultimately make the finding that she was capacitated, but more specifically, it's the specific fact that it found, because again, collateral estoppel is not looking at the claim as a whole, but the specific fact. And if we look at that statement, she recognizes she needs assistance, but she's capable of determining who she wants, that meets the requirements of capacity. What it
Counsel,
means is...
can may I interrupt you and follow up with that point?
Yes.
Am I wrong? But my understanding, but I want you to tell me if I'm wrong and you disagree with me, is that even if you have exactly the same issue, the exact same fact, the exact same parties, the exact same everything, but the burden of proof is different. There's a higher burden here, there's a lower burden there, in between the forums. Am I wrong? I was under the understanding that collateral estoppel, as a matter of law, doesn't apply to that. So is that correct or incorrect? And if it is incorrect, can you educate me on the subject?
I'm not aware of a case that says it's incorrect. I think certainly if you have an issue that was litigated under a lower standard, and now you're moving to a court where there's a higher standard to reach that finding, that would make sense. Logically, however, if the court is making this determination under a clear and convincing standard that's higher than a preponderance of evidence, and I mean, that would suggest that it's you know, even has even greater weight here. And I'd also say that, again, if we move away from the actual conclusion of the court that she had capacity and focus more on the actual factual finding, which was that she can handle her finances, she has the ability to say who she wants to handle her finances, that factual finding is not necessarily made under a standard. It's a fact that she can do these things. With respect to privity, the children have still not responded to their interests as individuals in the New York litigation, and co-trustees in that litigation are inextricably linked. And you can see that by the motions and the testimony that they gave. I'm still waiting to hear an articulation of what individual interest the children had in that litigation. All of their testimony, all of their motions were in support of maintaining control of that trust as co-trustees. Additionally, when you look at City of Richmond versus Davis, that case said that for purposes of collateral estoppel, a party includes any person who has a direct interest in a litigation and who has a right to control those proceedings, whether or not they choose to actually enter that litigation as a party. And in this case, obviously the children knew that this was a petition. Obviously they knew that part of the petition included an element that would decide whether or not Paula had capacity. Obviously, since she had already attempted to revoke the POA and the trust, they knew that this issue of capacity would affect their argument. And so if they wanted to challenge that, they could have. They chose not to. And so that does not preclude them from being considered a party or a privy for purposes of collateral estoppel here. With respect to the question of whether this issue was actually litigated, the appellants are trying to make the issue whether or not the trust was valid. But that wasn't the basis of Paula's plea and bar. The basis was her capacity. And if she had capacity, then her revocations of the trust and the power of attorney were valid, and there is no trust. So, and that also, I think, goes to the appellant's assertion that she's collaterally stopped from saying that the trust, collaterally stopped from saying that the trust is invalid, because that was something that the New York court found. But number one, again, I can't find any page in the trial record where the appellants argued that Paula was collaterally estopped from arguing anything, so I don't think that was preserved. And secondly, I don't know what, is it res judicata? Is it collateral estoppel? Is it bar? Is it merger? And third, I mean, if there is going to be some sort of preclusive effect, the children would have to admit that they were parties or privies to that prior litigation. Otherwise, they couldn't assert it either. With respect to Paula's testamentary capacity, and there in the reply brief was case law that said that New York's standard for capacity under an Article 81 hearing was different than New York's testamentary capacity. Well, nobody is here is arguing that New York testamentary capacity applies, so that doesn't matter. What matters is the factual finding that the court made, does that meet the requirement under Virginia law? I apologize. And what the requirement is under Virginia law is that the person can recollect their property. In this case, that finding was she knew she had property. She knows she had a trust. She tried to revoke it. So she knows what the trust is. She knows what her property is. She knew what she was doing when she revoked the trust and the POA, because the court found, again, not particularly on the issue of the revocation, but on the issue of, does she know what she wants to do with it? Yes, that was part of her petition. She wanted to transfer control over her finances to Jennifer. And did she know what she was doing? And she does know that by revoking the trust, she is transferring that, she is transferring the power over her assets, including her assets in the trust, to Jennifer, because Jennifer then can then go ahead and revoke that trust, just as Paula did beforehand. Finally, the appellants argue that this is not the proper subject of a plea and bar. They cite to Our Lady of Peace, but that is Our Lady of Peace, as the court said there, that wasn't really a plea and bar. That's what the parties called it, but it really was an ore tenens hearing, and there was evidence given in that case. And so that's a completely different framework that we're looking at. The framework here is we look at the complaint, we look at the attachments to the complaint, and that includes the New York order, and we decide based on the complaint, the four corners and the attachment, whether we can reach a conclusion that the issue of Paula's capacity is collaterally. And we have the ability to do that. Everything we need to know is in the complaint, and it is in the New York Court. If there are no other questions, I'll cede my time.
All right. Ms. Kramer, you have 2 minutes, 49 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, in response to counsel's arguments, counsel made an argument that the individual interest of the individuals, the people themselves, Tom and Beth, were the same as their fiduciary interest. There was no evidence at the plea and bar of this presented, and the case law says the opposite, that a person who is sued or sues in his official or representative capacity is regarded as a person distinct from the same person in his individual capacity, who's a stranger to his rights or liability as an individual. If Mrs. Plofchan wanted to make this argument that the fiduciaries were the same as the children that appeared in New York, there would need to be some evidence of that. There was no evidence presented at the plea and bar to sustain that finding. Additionally, counsel argued that New York testament, nobody is arguing New York testamentary capacity. We're not arguing to apply New York law. Well, Your Honor, as a practical matter, it would be an absurdity if New York would not apply their own standard for Article 81 hearings for a testamentary capacity, but Virginia is going to say, we will take that standard for testamentary capacity. Again, counsel has argued that Mrs. Plofchan knew what she was doing, that's why she proceeded with this guardianship proceeding, but there was no evidence presented at the plea and bar in this matter to suggest that, so that Mrs. Plofchan could meet her burden with regard to proving that. Additionally, Your Honor, just briefly, with regard to there's a fourth count of the complaint here in Virginia that was a motion for fee and cost that was not subject to the plea and bar. There was no arguments in Mrs. Plofchun's plea and bar relative to that motion, and there was no demur as to the sufficiency of that count. And the court here erred in granting a plea and bar to the entire matter when that wasn't even addressed or wasn't even before the court. There was no challenge to the sufficiency. Accordingly, Your Honors, the court below erred in sustaining that plea and bar to the issue of fees and costs because it could not have been resolved by a plea. Wrapping up, Your Honors, the trial court's finding erodes the distinction between actions in an individual capacity versus actions in a fiduciary capacity, and it also erodes the clear Virginia precedent required for a finding in a testamentary capacity. Again, briefly, there's a different standard. There was no evidence presented, and there were different parties. For those reasons, Your Honor, I would submit that the court below erred in sustaining Mrs. Plofchun's plea and bar. I'd ask that this court to reverse and remand the matter for trial in the Circuit Court of Fairfax County. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer. The court will be in recess until 12:15 when they will come back into the justices' conference room. The court will also be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.